It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Andy Conti from the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, in for Paul Guggenheimer. Coming up on the program, we'll meet two gentlemen with unique perspectives on Pittsburgh. John Brewer keeps watch over a treasure trove of photos from the archives of the Pittsburgh Courier, along with other items chronicling decades of African-American life. And later, concierge Robert Miles is the go-to guy for entertaining out-of-town guests and more. Up front, encouraging more women to enter the STEM fields isn't a question of how, but when. In my role as a reporter for the Tribune Review, I looked into this issue, which has also been a focus of WESA's Life of Learning initiative. As the father of a middle school girl, I also feel this issue close at home. Joining me in the studio are Teresa Richards, a Carnegie Mellon University Robotics Program Coordinator, and Lauren Scheller-Wolf, a student and past participant on the Girls of Steel Robotics team. Terry and Lauren, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a question or comment, you can call us at 412-246-2002, or you can email us at esspgh@wesa.fm, or reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH. Terry, why don't you start out by telling us a little bit about the Girls of Steel Robotics team? What is it exactly?
Well, thank you. The Girls of Steel Robotics team is a group that's mentored at Carnegie Mellon University's Field Robotics Center. We actually meet in Newell Simon Hall in the Robotics Institute. The group of girls this past year was about 50, including girls from 8th grade to 12th grade. And we participate in the first robotics competition every year. And we were founded in 2010 by Patty Rote and George Cantor. Now, you might be wondering what FIRST stands for. FIRST stands for Inspiration and Recognition of Science and Technology. And it's an organization that was started by Dean Kamen about 20-plus years ago.
No, I'm just going to jump in there because it's so impressive what you guys do. As I mentioned, I have a daughter who's in sixth grade, and she came over and toured your facility. There's a program at CMU that's called Tech Nights every Monday night. And part of it, the last thing was to walk through and see the robots that you guys are building. And Lauren, you were one of the guides that night. I have to tell you, you were so articulate. That's why I wanted to have you on the show to talk about it. How does that all come together? How did you get interested in this project?
Well, thank you, first off. I actually did Tech Nights when I was in middle school, and so I learned about Girls of Steel there, and I had a few close friends on the team who basically said, this program is amazing, you should join.
And so Tech Nights, just to back it up a little bit, that's basically a group of middle school girls that meets every Monday night, and they focus on different aspects of science and technology, right?
Yeah.
And what was it that you learned then when you went to the robotics program? And did you already have any abilities when you got there? Did you think, I know how to build a robot already?
No, I had no idea. I think that's one of the good things about Girls of Steel, that you don't have to have any idea about anything having to do with engineering or anything like that, because you learn everything over the course of the season.
So we toured about a month ago, and that's what blew me away, because there were all these young women there saying, well, I didn't even know what a bolt was, back in the fall, and now they were putting together these robots. Terry, can you talk a little bit about, you started to hint on it, but this all feeds into a national program, is that right? And so the robot that the girls build, what goes out and competes with robots from across the country?
Yeah, that's right. So the robot that is built by Girls of Steel this past year competed in two regional competitions, and it is a national or international organization, but teams start competing at sort of the regional or local level. So Girls of Steel competed in Pittsburgh or at California University of Pennsylvania and at the Buckeye Regional, which is in Cleveland, Ohio.
And these aren't like the battle bots where they go and destroy each other. What's the competition entail?
Well, no, it's not battle bots, but this year the competition entailed robots having to move or stack, recycling totes or recycling bins in certain configurations. So the teams participate on alliances, three robots against three robots, and they compete basically red on the red side and on the blue side.
It's amazing that you can put something together that serves that purpose.
And that's what Lauren did. Lauren did part of the building.
Can you talk a little bit about why that's so important for young girls to get involved with a program like this while they're still in middle school? I mean, some parents, probably I would have, you know, a year ago said, well, maybe that's a little bit early, but why is that at such a critical age for?
Well, one of the things we decided last year and the year before was to invite middle school girls to actually join our team as junior members. So we accepted girls who were in eighth grade, and we just felt that an eighth grader would, I guess, be able to confirm her interest in joining the team as a high schooler if she were able to participate sort of on a regular basis, or in some cases on a limited basis, depending on her schedule, to just find out what it's like. So in order to see girls who are successful, I think that's one of the things that's important for the middle school girls, to see older girls.
Right. Lauren, did you have an interest or an expectation that you were going to be able to build robots? And did you a year or two ago think, well, this is something that I'm going to be doing with my life as a high schooler?
I didn't. So I knew when I was joining the team that this is a team that builds robots, but I really had no idea just how much I would learn, how quickly.
And so how has that affected your career aspirations? Obviously, you've got a lot of time to figure it out, but are you already starting to think, well, maybe this is something I could do the rest of my life?
I am, yes. Last year, if you'd asked me, I would not have said engineering. Now I'm considering.
What would you have said?
Theater or writing.
Okay.
Which are still things I'm considering.
Still great. Writing, still very nice. Okay, go on.
But I haven't decided anything yet.
Okay. But now you think, well, this could be something that that you could do. Terry, can you talk about how that kind of decision making then, how critical is that for girls? Because my story when I wrote about it and why I got interested in this topic was that I had attended a conference on cybersecurity, and it was about 50 people and there were about 5 women there. The rest were men. And it seemed unusual, but when I started doing research, I learned that was about accurate. What are you trying to encourage these girls to think about when they're looking at their career possibilities, what they could do with their lives?
Well, I think one of the things that's important for girls when they're trying to think about what they want to do for careers or later on in their life is to see people who do what they're interested in doing. So what we try to do is get them exposed to, I guess, experiences where they're going to meet people who are in the field. So they do that with some of the mentors who work with the girls on the team, our female computer scientists, for example, or our engineers. And we've also had instances where students from Carnegie Mellon who represent the Society of Women Engineers have come in to give talks to our students so that they can learn what to expect. So I think it's important for the girls to see other girls or even older girls doing what they think they might want to do.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Andy Conti from the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, sitting in for Paul Guggenheimer. We're discussing what it takes to encourage more girls to enter the STEM fields. My guests are Terry Richards, a Carnegie Mellon University Robotics Program Coordinator, and Lauren Scheller-Wolf, a student and past participant on the Girls of Steel Robotics team. Terry, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit with this. How did you yourself get involved with science, and were you thinking as a middle school girl, probably not that long ago, that this was something you might want to do for your career?
Well, I think I'll step back a little bit and think it was probably teachers that I had in high school who influenced me by supporting interests, by inviting me to do field trips with them, do special projects with them. And I think that's what influenced me to pursue a career in STEM. I was a researcher right after college. Then I went to graduate school at Carnegie Mellon. I did some more research there. And then I started working as a high school teacher.
Right. And so this pulls all together then, your interest in science, but also your ability to work with young people.
Right, right.
So I understand one of the things that came out of this was this Big Hero 6 character, that this was the big blockbuster cartoon movie of last summer, right? And one of the characters is based upon the Girls of Steel. How did that come about?
Well, I wouldn't say And they don't say that it was based on Girls of Steel, but in 2011, there were representatives from Disney who came to visit Carnegie Mellon on their research trip trying to learn about robotics.
That's
and people
cool.
who build robots. Right. It was pretty cool. So they met Professor Akison, for example, who was doing research in soft robotics. Then they actually had an opportunity to meet Girls of Steel. And we've been told that meeting the girls was pretty inspirational for at least the two female characters. So their can-do attitude, for example, their spirit of just being able to do things basically inspired Honey, Lemon, and Go-Go Tamago in Big Hero 6.
Honey, and it was Honey Lemon, right, that was the one that was tied to the Girls of Steel?
Actually, they claim both were,
oh, both? Okay,
were, you know, sort of given the spirit of Girls of Steel.
Yeah, that's perfect. Lauren, maybe you can talk a little bit about the spirit of the Girls of Steel. And I should point out that you're wearing a Rosie the Riveter type handkerchief in your hair, and you have Rosie on your T-shirt as well with the, it says Girls of Steel Robotics on it. Tell us about the spirit and how Rosie the Riveter fits into all of that.
Well, Rosie the Riveter was and is a symbol of female empowerment. So I think, and that's one of the main ideas of Girls of Steel, that because engineering, like you said, is so much a guy's world, that Girls of Steel basically, its mission is to go out there and say, no, girls can do this too. It's not just for guys.
When you guys have a reputation now, I'm sure when you get out there, people are used to it. But is there still that moment when you roll up on the scene and you've got your all-girls robotics team and you go up against teams that are what? Are there any other all-girls teams?
There are a few other all-girls teams. It is amazing, though, when you go to the competitions that you'll have teams that have maybe 40 or 50 people on them and you'll have three or four girls on that team. So it's kind of shocking going from an all-girls team to something that's so heavily dominated by guys.
Now, and you're homeschooled, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but you have friends outside of homeschooling.
Yeah.
And so what do you, how do you share your experiences with them? And is something that you try to encourage other girls to get involved in?
Well, basically, I just talk about Girls of Steel a lot.
And does it seem to resonate with other girls, or do you get girls pushing back and saying, well, that doesn't sound like it's for me. That sounds like something that I wouldn't be interested in.
I think it does resonate with them.
Yeah. And what about for you, Terry, when you're out and you're looking at the teams and thinking about your team, how did it come about that you were only going to have girls on the team? Why was it important to have an all-girls robotics team?
Well, it was important to our founder, Patty Rote, wanted Pittsburgh to be represented with an all-girls team. There are about 30 or 35 all-girls teams in the world out of about 3,000 that compete at our level, which is the FRC level. So it's a pretty small number of girls that compete with, you know, or build robots just with girls. And it was important to her to have girls in Pittsburgh represented on first robotics teams.
Do you have a program for boys as well? I have a son as well, I should mention. He's in ninth grade already. So
we don't, but actually I've heard a couple of times from people who've asked if there's a Boys of Steel, and we've said no, not yet. But we do have boys who were eligible to participate at our first LEGO League competition level, which is a middle school LEGO robotics program, and we do accept boys into that program. And then our hope is that they would join teams at their schools or even start teams on their own.
Okay. I remember from my research for the story in the Tribune Review that this was something that was closely related to the women of the School of Computer Science, right? And they were telling me there that the program, the Women of SCS, has become so popular that they actually have a program now for men, that this is men are trying to get involved in these things.
Uh-huh.
We need help, too. It's not right.
Well, there's no reason to exclude men. It's just that we want to make sure that girls know they can do it.
Right. So, Lauren, how did things work out for you this year then? How did the competition turn out?
Well, for me personally, it was all very exciting because it was my first year.
And where was it? You traveled, right? There were the local ones, but then there was a national competition?
Yeah. So the national one was in St. Louis, and that was actually the international championships. So we were very excited to be able to go.
And how did you place? Did you do
well? So at Champs, our robot placed about 55th out of 76th or something in our division. And we won two awards. We won the Entrepreneurship Award, which is for the team that has the best business plan. And we also won the Innovation in Media and Technology Award, sponsored by Comcast, which is for the team that basically uses social media, so Facebook, Twitter, everything, to basically get their message out there and spread the word.
And what do you do on social media that makes your program so unique?
Well, we use pretty much all the social media sites, and we blog. We have a YouTube channel, Five Awesome Robots, that we and other FRC teams upload videos to, things like that.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Comcast was basically impressed with the continuity of images and how the website was represented, and Twitter and YouTube and Instagram and so on, and Tumblr even.
Right. And to be clear, you didn't destroy any other robots, right? There was no...
No.
that's the boy in me talking, that would be. The can you talk a little bit, Terry, how can girls get involved? Or if parents are listening, what should they tell their children to get them involved in this, get their daughters involved?
Well, I always tell people, write to us at girlsofsteelrobotics@gmail.com. That's basically all one word, @gmail.com, Girls of Steel Robotics. And you can inquire about opportunities, inquire about when the applications for joining the high school level team is going to be available, or even to join the first LEGO League level team, which basically will be starting in August. We also offer outreach opportunities. We have camps that we're offering this summer. Two of them are actually full, though. But we do have one that's going to be held at CalU's facility at South Point. It's an introduction to the FTC platform of FIRST Robotics, FIRST Tech Challenge. We're going to offer that to girls who live in Greene County, Fayette County, and Washington County. And we're also going to be at the labs at Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh two times this summer, June 24th and July 1st. So people could meet us there and ask us about, you know, what we do, or get to come and see what we do. But the main point of contact is to write to girlsofsteelrobotics@gmail.com.
Okay. And you have a website as well?
We do. And that is girlsofsteelrobotics.com.
Okay. And so there's maybe one summer camp left, and or some spots left in one summer camp, and then the Girl of Steel's program really starts in the fall then, is that right? And what's the time commitment like for that, Lauren?
So build season, which is the 6 weeks we have to build our robot, is the busiest time. That is early January to mid-February. So the time commitment for that is we meet four times a week for 3 to 6 hours, and you have to average 10 hours a week, but it is an average. So if there was a week that you absolutely could not come for whatever reason, as long as you make it up, that's fine.
And so we're wrapping up, but in 30 seconds, we call it an elevator pitch. So if you get in an elevator and you've got to sell your program or your story, Lauren, what would you tell young girls who are listening why they should get involved in this program?
It's an amazing opportunity. You will learn so much, but it's the kind of learning that it's so fun that you don't realize you're learning anything. And it's very exciting.
That's the best kind.
That's a great way to put it.
Terry Richards and Lauren Scheller-Wolf, thank you for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
Coming up, if a picture is worth 1,000 words, photos within the Pittsburgh Coliseum in Homewood speak volumes. Author and historian John Brewer will tell us about his efforts to preserve a collection of photos from the Pittsburgh Courier chronicling decades of African-American life. I'm Andy Conti, sitting in for Paul Guggenheimer, and you're listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. Welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Andy Conti of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, sitting in for Paul Guggenheimer. We've stepped outside of the studio to go to the Pittsburgh Coliseum in Homewood. It's really an old trolley barn, but our next guest, John Brewer, has turned it into a community center and a repository for Pittsburgh history, especially for Pittsburgh's Black history and African Americans in this region and all across the country. John, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Andy.
So tell us a little bit to start out with how you turned this trolley barn into a place that now holds concerts where you get 1,000 people on weekend nights.
Well, I first came here about 20, 25 years ago, and under the inspiration of former city councilman Dwayne Darkins, asked me to look into this building. It was a defunct skating rink. In fact, it was completely defunct. So I came in the building and was inspired myself, and I decided that I would take this on as a task, which I did, and gathered some friends, and we looked around, and we looked at this space. It's a very large space, and we decided one of the first things to do was to try to attract attention here. So we managed to have free birthday parties for the kids if the parents would bring a car and park it on the parking lot. That was the hook for other people to ride by to see there was things going on. From that point, that attracted some people who wanted to do large parties, large cabarets, eventually bingos, then concerts, productions for small theater companies, and so forth. And from that point, it kind of snowballed.
I mean, you have turned this into more than just a community center, though. This is not just a place where people come and have parties. You've covered the walls of the place with historic photos. A lot of them are photos that tell the life of old Pittsburgh, but also that tell the life of African Americans who lived in Pittsburgh. Tell me about how that came together and why that was so important for you to make this a place that is a repository for all of that history.
Well, this place was always history. When it was a trolley barn, when I was a kid, I used to run through this place every morning and get called obscene names by the workers. I found that this place employed people, was a center, so it was kind of ironic that I ended up coming back and owning the facility. But one thing I had to mark was kind of a dedication for our ancestors, people who have struggled, who have went through all kinds of civil rights activities to give us opportunities. And so I decided that I would always have a culture or art component. Also, my wife is a nationally known fiber artist, and she felt very heavy about the art and cultural commitment. So since we've had the place, we've always had art. We've always had celebrations of ancestors, celebrations of people who have done things here in Pittsburgh and around the world who are from this community and other communities. If you come inside the place, you'll see 200 and some photos of Westinghouse High School graduates. We're able to attract people to see them because they were known locally, nationally, and even some cases internationally. So the cultural component was always a part of this facility.
Now, John, you and I met several months ago while I was working on a project about one of my favorite people, Bill Nunn, who's the sports editor at the Pittsburgh Courier for many years and also a scout for the Pittsburgh Steelers, who went and scoured the Black colleges and found a lot of those players. And now I got excited whenever we met because a lot of that history is hard to track down. And when I met you, you said, oh, yeah, I know all about it. And not only do I know about it, I've got the goods to back it up. Talk a little bit about the photographs that you found. First, what they are. Why don't you explain to the listeners exactly what you did find?
Well, what many call the Holy Grail is something that happened back in 2005. It was somewhat ironic that at the time that discovery was made, I was pretty enthused about the Charles Tini Harris photo project that the Carnegie was conducting. In fact, I accepted as an assignment to try to help them to accelerate the identification process. Tini's photos, as most people know, were not identified. So I was really in a process of trying to find more information about Tini Harris. And I went to the Courier because I realized that Tini worked for the Courier for many years, and I figured they would have the photos. Well, as it turned out, the Courier went through some series of things back in the 60s that caused them to lose their plant, and they moved from their plant to an office on the south side. And so it was thought that everything was lost. That was back in 1966. So here I come in 2005, and I don't take instructions very well, so I ended up coming in the building, looking around, and I stumped into this closet. And this closet had a really critical part of their archives, which was 100 volumes of books composed of the news from 1950 on. it proved to be a real key component. Interesting thing about that is that on the way to the courier office that day, I rode by Homewood Cemetery, and my car stalled and stopped. And when it stopped, I didn't realize what the situation was, but I got out of the car, and I looked up, and I saw a mausoleum. And the mausoleum had the name Robert L. Vann carved on it. Robert L. Vann, of course, was one of the founders of the Pittsburgh Courier. So at that point, I felt a kind of an ancestral charge that something was going to happen, and something did happen. And so from that point, that really inspired me to look a little deeper into the office, and we found those things. We looked at the photos. The photos were ranging somewhere in the neighborhood of 500,000, 600,000 photos, and they were from the mid-20s on to the current day. So the photographs itself are majority of them are black and white. They're done very well. They're all originals. They come from not just one photographer, but they come from a couple hundred photographers, not only locally but nationally and even internationally. People that you perhaps have heard about, like Gordon Parks, you might see some of his photos. So what I found that it was just an entire new culture, a new grail of things that had not been disclosed for the last 40 years.
You're listening to Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Andy Conti of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, sitting in for Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with John Brewer, who is the owner of the Pittsburgh Coliseum in Homewood, and he's also a historian and a book author and somebody who hit on one of the biggest troves of African-American history in Pittsburgh and really the whole country, and that's what he's talking to us about today. John, for our listeners, can you put into some perspective what the Pittsburgh Courier meant to black citizens across the country? I don't think a lot of Pittsburghers necessarily remember just how significant this newspaper was. What was its role for not just Western Pennsylvania, but for really the entire country?
Well, the Pittsburgh Courier was pretty much the most popular and, should I say, essential black-owned paper in the country at one point, simply because of the issues that were happening, the civil rights issues, the issues of people being hung, the issues of discrimination, all the kind of things that have happened through history, the coverage on the Scottsboro Boys, the coverage on Emmett Till in the 50s, the entire civil rights movement, and also the wars, World War I, World War II, the Great Depression. The Pittsburgh Courier covered all those aspects. They had the best writers. They had the best columnists. They had the best historians. J.A. Rogers, he's a very well-known historian, at one point wanted to find out what was happening in Ethiopia with Haile Selassie being under attack by Mussolini. And so he went to Ethiopia, and he reported back what was happening. So they had international correspondents. They had war correspondents. And really, they were probably the most centrally required paper in the country. Of course, there are other papers making coverage, but the Pittsburgh Courier had 21 editions. It was in 12 different states. They had a national edition that even went as far as South America and Europe. So it was the black voice being heard worldwide.
As history writers, you and I both have kind of geeked out on this. It's a great story, and it's a really a rich Pittsburgh story. You had the moment, though, that every historian hopes for. You know, when you walked in, you just described that you were over at the Courier, you walked into this closet, and there was this trove of history that hadn't been touched for years and that people actually had forgotten about, didn't know it even existed. What was that like for you in that moment? What did it feel like when you walked in that door?
Well, you know, Andy, as a person who was a former sports person, I played a lot of sports. I played football, ran track, and there's a certain exhilaration you get with that, and you kind of say, well, that's the greatest feeling in the world. But it doesn't even touch the feeling of discovering 100 years of hard work, of things that were missing. I'm not a person who gets excited real easy, but my heart was pumping all over the place when I pulled that first book out. I shared that with the Carnegie Museum of Art, and we both were hyperventilating within 10 minutes of seeing what was in that closet. So it's a feeling unlike any other feeling that I've ever had. And, you know, it's something that you crave for. Everyone wants to try to find something and something meaningful. Well, this is probably the most meaningful thing that I've ever found.
So when you did find it and you went back to the Courier offices and you said, hey, I found all this stuff up in the attic, how did that play out? What happened with the newspaper? What was their reaction? And how did you, I know you've moved some of the photographs here to the Coliseum, so how did all that come together?
Well, the way it came together was the discovery was made actually in the closet in the Corey office in the South Side. In 1966, there was this throwout, and it was a report that everything was thrown out. The employees at the Courier, at the time that I got there, were not familiar with what happened. In fact, they weren't there in 1966. There was only one lady who was employed at that time. So there wasn't this knowledge base about what happened. Once we made the discovery, we shared that, of course, with the Courier because we were right there, and they became very excited. And what we decided to do is to try to get some support to have this collection preserved. We found ourselves leaving the city. We went to Washington, D.C. And because of the support of Congressman Altmaier and Congressman Doyle in connection to Congressman John Lewis in D.C., we went there and we gave them a program. We showed them what we had, and they became extremely excited. And they introduced us to what is called the National Treasure Fund. We got a grant, and that allowed us to get some money to begin to extract and start to preserve those photos. So what we have at this point is I actually pulled those photos out of the Courier office, not all of them, but a percentage of them, and brought them here, and we had enough money to begin to preserve those, to put protective sleeves on them and other things that would prevent any further deterioration of the photos and the documents. It was a grand adventure. We received the funding. Of course, that's not enough funding to do 600,000 photos, but we did get enough funding to get the preservation process started. They are not digitized, but the ones that we have are preserved. And because they're preserved, it puts us in a better position to help people, scholars, educators, doctors, lawyers, people who are writing books, and people who are doing documentation about our history.
It's great that you connected with Representative John Lewis. He's one of my favorite people, really. Someone who's got an inspiring story on his own, and I know you know him from back in the day, too. Of the stuff that you have here, the information, the photographs that you've been able to collect, what is your aspiration for them and for making that available to the public? I know you're a book writer. You've got a new book coming out, The Kingpins of Pittsburgh, about some of the numbers runners from back in the day, and you've got a book coming out on the Hill District. But what is your hope for the images that you have here? Is there a way to get those out so that more people can see them and that they'll be preserved for all time?
Yes, the archive is so vast, no one person could ever encompass the archive. The archive is really meant for educators, for people who have interests in their history. We have a lot of people who do their own personal history. A lot of people have found their families resting in an archive that they were not aware of. But the archive should be produced. It should be made public. It should be digitized so that the public can make better use of it. There are probably 10,000 PhDs waiting to be written out of that archive, but not only just from the college level, but at the high school and even the grade school level. People can see these images, and they can see reflections of themselves. And to me, this archive was meant to be shared. It wasn't meant to be set on a shelf somewhere, but it was meant to be shared and made public. And the people who want to use it should have instant availability to be able to use it.
You mentioned earlier the Teenie Harris collection and the work that's been done at the Carnegie Museums with Teenie Harris, which is just phenomenal. But as you kind of mentioned there, too, it's a blessing, but in some ways it's also a curse because there's so much information, and what do you do with it? I mean, you've got a chance right now. We've got the ears of Pittsburgh listening. Is there anything that you would want from the public? What kind of help do you need for this? What would you like to see happen?
Well, what I would like to see happen is for the kind of finances that be required to be able to digitize this collection. It should be done under professional care, like a museum or a foundation or whatever that has that kind of money. You know, it's unfortunate you have to ask for money, but really the bottom line is unless you're able to finance it and put it up to the public, you know, it's not going to help anybody. Right now, we're in a one-on-one situation. One person calls, I help one person. Five people call, I help five people. But this thing is meant to supply information for thousands and thousands of people.
Do you feel a great sense of responsibility with this stuff? You have so much information, so many unique images, and how does that responsibility weigh on you when you think about it?
Well, yeah, it definitely weighs on me. I constantly think about it. The images are like permutations running through my mind from day to day. But I also feel grateful that I had that kind of opportunity. You know, the archives not only involves other people's family, but involves my family. And so I can go back and I can see who my father's hero was. I can see who my father's uncle's hero was. And in that sense, whatever kind of pressure that one perceive that I have is really minimal. The responsibility of being a caretaker is something that I wanted to do. You can't just discover something and throw it in the side and keep going. You have to attend to it. So I feel good about that. I feel privileged that the courier allowed me to come into their office as a non-employee and help make this discovery, and also that they supported that.
We've been talking with John Brewer, the owner of the Pittsburgh Coliseum in Homewood, and a historian and book author. John, on behalf of Pittsburghers and as a Pittsburgh history writer myself, I want to thank you personally for doing all this and also for having us out here to your place today.
Andy, thank you again for being here in Essential Pittsburgh.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Andy Conti of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, sitting in for Paul Guggenheimer. Need help getting tickets for a game, an anniversary gift, restaurant recommendations? Robert Miles says he can get it done. He's the owner of Downtown Concierge Services, and he's at your service. Robert Miles, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited about the opportunity to talk to you about this.
So, Robert, tell us a little bit about this. We all know what a concierge is. You know, you stay at a fancy hotel, you've got somebody there who's going to answer your questions, help you get tickets, find a way around town. But you're not doing it for a hotel anymore. You're doing this for the entire city of Pittsburgh.
That's correct.
How does that work?
Well, I found when I left the hotel business that in research that there was just seemed to be a lack of services for our guests and tourists visiting Pittsburgh. I mean, there's certain select areas, but if you don't know where it's at, you would be hard to find. And I see people who seem to be lost and not knowing what to do here. So that kind of was the brainchild for this business. And we found that what we like to do is make sure that we contact people or they contact us when they know they're coming for a visit so that we can help them make the best of their time while they're visiting Pittsburgh.
Do you also get Pittsburghers who want the services?
We do. Well, especially now with all of the changes in downtown Pittsburgh and the restaurant scene and all these interesting and exciting things going on, Pittsburghers are probably the last to know what's happening in downtown Pittsburgh. So I do get a lot of people calling me and say, hey, we have a company coming in. What's a good restaurant, new restaurant that we can take them to? Because they really don't know.
Now, I'm guessing most of the people who call you are in like cold sweat panic by the time they call. Does that happen? Or is it like people saying, hey, I need your help. This is a few weeks out.
I do get a lot of panicked last-minute calls, but a lot of what I get also are like corporations who are coming for a conference will call me weeks in advance, and I set up their reservations for their restaurants, make sure that they're taken care of for the duration of their stay, or to make sure that, like I said, they're making the best use of their free time.
So give us a sense of the kinds of things you do. So you do restaurants, tickets. What else?
We do restaurants, tickets. We set up tours. We try to help with bridal showers, private tours. I do have a car service that I work with who will take me with you on a private tour of the city for two, four people in a town car. You have me for two or three hours, serve champagne, talk about the city, and show you what the city's really about.
Do you? That's pretty amazing. That's a great service. Do you get people who say, Robert, we want you to be with us? You know, maybe not physically with us, but be on call the entire weekend. I don't know what
I tell people that, too. Here's my number. You know, I mean, I may set up their itinerary, but please, if you have any questions, feel free to call me. Because I realize that, you know, this can be a hard to navigate city, and, you know, people can be lost without, they're probably not, but they think they are.
All right,
so you have to talk them down.
Let's hear some of, yeah, absolutely. We've all been lost, even those of us who live here, right?
Right.
To be a visitor is terrible. Give us some of your greatest hits. What's the most amazing thing you pulled off, the most out of control request you got, and you pulled it together?
Well, probably one of the strangest was when I was a concierge in Washington, D.C. I had a couple who was getting married. They were getting married, and they wanted to kind of change genders, and he did the wedding gown and she did the tuxedo, and this was kind of a joke to their family. And so trying to find clothing for him.
On how much time? This was like a
This was like in an afternoon.
Oh, no. Wow.
Yeah. So yeah. Trying to pull that together. And, you know, the girl was pretty easy. The guy was a little more difficult because he was a big man. So, you know, finding size 15 shoes for a man is pretty difficult to do it at the last minute. But I did it because I just happened to know the resources.
Wow, that's great. And did you go to the wedding?
I didn't.
No,
I didn't. I wasn't invited.
See, and you also do proposals, right? You get people
right.
who...
Yeah, I've been involved in a lot of proposals. Those are my favorite, just because, I mean, I really get all teared up when I, you know, because I'm always somewhere in the background watching, and they're just so romantic, and, you know, just to be a part of somebody's special day like that. And then, I mean, I always say, I'm my business is one of those where you meet people one day, and the next day they're hugging you goodbye when they leave.
Yeah,
I mean, you've
great.
Become such a part of their life for a very short period of time, but you really find out the things they like, the things they're very interested in, and you really try to gear everything towards what they like.
You're listening to Essential Pittsburgh. This is Andy Conti of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review sitting in for Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with Robert Miles, owner of Downtown Concierge Services. So, Robert, in terms of these proposals, what are some of the more romantic things you've done for people?
Well, I mean, even anniversaries I do a lot of, but if I know, people usually get, it's usually the guy, of course, will call me. And I mean, I just say, all right, I'll take it from here. And especially like in the hotel setting, if they have a room for the night, I will get flowers delivered to the room. I usually have the guy or the girl, whoever's doing this, fill out a card, and I have that in the room with champagne, glasses, you know, the rose petals on the bed, the whole thing. And, you know, so, and the hotels are very good with working with me on these things. You know, I think over the years, when you work in one hotel, you kind of know people in every hotel. So, you know, and people are very grateful to have, you know, someone who is really looking out to, you know, provide these kinds of services for people, you know, because hotels don't do it anymore.
Right. When have you gotten stumped? Have you had questions where people say, like, I just cannot pull this off?
Well, I do get stumped, but I'm one of those people who really likes research. So if I don't know, I won't say I don't know. I will say I will find out for you. But not really. I think I try to stay on top of it because that's part. I mean, that is what you're selling is knowledge. And you have to really know what's happening. And my friends even are very surprised that I know so much about what's happening in the scene in the city, but that's what I do. That's what I follow. You know, so, I mean, I know a lot of things that are probably out of my age group even, that people are very surprised. I know where this band's playing and, you know. So.
Well, sure, you've got to know everything.
Right,
for
absolutely
your clients.
You do. And I don't like to be called on the carpet for, and you know, it's something that's not correct. So I make sure what I'm sharing is true.
Do you give our listeners a sense of how they can find you and what it costs to hire you?
Well, I mean, if you go to my website, which is Downtown Concierge Services Pittsburgh.webs.com.
Pittsburgh spelled out.
Pittsburgh spelled okay. out. There's a list of services, but my services go beyond that. There's probably nothing you can't think of that I wouldn't be able to do.
Okay.
And so, but
and it's not, you're not just working for gratuities, but people can.
Right. I do have paid services. On, okay. Gratuities, of course, are always appreciated.
Right, sure.
And then
when somebody calls you up, do they just throw their question out to you? Or
right.
what is the.
Or okay. email me. But I say on my website, if you want to call me just for a restaurant recommendation for an evening, that's a free service. I do that for free, and I will even call and make the reservation for you. Now, other services, you know, weddings, I set up weddings for people, you know, those things, you know, you have to get in touch with me, and
okay.
we do, you know, a lot of this through email.
All right. So some of the. This is. the chance to talk to a concierge is like talking to a magician, right? So
right.
I'm going to ask you to give up some of your secrets here. So you, and if you, you know, if you professional secrets you can't give up, how do you get tickets for a sold out concert? Great tickets. You get people in there. How do you do that?
We know.
All right, you can't.
You have to know people, of course. But I, you know, people will be surprised to hear this, but I always say try StubHub first. And that is always my answer because they have their own blocks of seats. So you may call the stadium and they have nothing where StubHub will still be holding on to some tickets. So, but now I know people. Let's just put it that way. I can usually get tickets for anything, even sold out.
Yeah, so that's the advantage of knowing that. They are available.
It's just you, if you're willing to pay the price, I can find it for you.
Right. Well, I imagine that's part of the problem, too. People contact you and it's, well, that's out of my price.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, people call me and thinking, you know, as a magician, I can get them a $20 ticket. That's not going to happen.
Right.
You know, that just does not happen.
What about, okay, so say I called you up today and I said, all right, I need to plan a wedding for tomorrow.
Can I could do it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I have vendors that I work with that have become friends in the flower business. I mean, you know, I know I actually have a list of clergy and people who will do weddings that, you know, are non-denominational. So, I mean, I've got my guns already.
Yeah, that's great. And what about bachelor and bachelorette parties? If people come to town and they've not planned this out. Does that ever happen?
It happens all the time. And I find that very amazing that you've probably known for months you're going to this wedding and you show up in Pittsburgh with a group of girls or guys and you have no idea. All right, we need a bachelorette party. But I happen to know the restaurants that have spaces on particular nights that can be done. You know, cakes are really easy to get a hold of. You know, strippers if you need, you know, that for either gender, you know. So, you know, that's always part of that group. So
it's a family show, Robert.
That's cool.
No, that's fine. I'm sure you get all kinds of requests like that. And you know, what do you do to keep it clean and to say, you know, hey, this
well,
is
just great. You know, I think for me, I mean, there's a certain way I want to present myself, and I, you know, so it's important to me to keep. There are certain things I will not do. And I just don't want to, I don't need it to be doing those kind of things. People ask, but it's also all in the presentation, how they ask and how discreet they can be. And that's part of my job is to be discreet. I don't share information, what people ask for. That's just, you know, that's their business.
Right. So what are some of the things you're working on now? Do you have some long-term projects that you're excited about?
Well, right. Just now, I just accepted a position. I'm going to be the general manager of a small hotel bed and breakfast that's going to be opening in Deutschtown on Northside. But I'll still be working still doing my concierge service with that tied in to this new business. It's called the Allegheny Inn. It'll be opening sometime this summer. So.
That's going to be a real change from going from a big hotel to a little inn.
Right, it will. But this will be my responsibility right down to, you know, arranging flowers to, you know, making the breakfast to, you know, talking with the people. And I'm really looking forward to it.
I imagine that a lot of the people who come in from out of town are looking for authentic Pittsburgh things as well. And so what are some of your go-to Pittsburgh experiences that you...
Well, you know, there's always the basics, you know, Primanti Brothers, you know, the Duquesne Incline, Mount Washington, and those are the go-to things. But it's nice that now suddenly it's like we have Market Square, we have Penn Avenue just in downtown. So now these things have become part of the culture of the city that we didn't have 5 years ago. You know, so it's just nice that now we have so much to offer our visitors, you know, even just in downtown. And I found in the hotel business that people, especially if you're here for business, don't like to stray far from their hotel. You know, so you have to really know the downtown Golden Triangle area.
Well, you're really an ambassador for the city as well,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. I hope that I am. That's what I, you know, I mean, I love this city. I've lived here for 40 years. It's my hood. I mean, this is where I hang out. I know what's going on here, and I love to sell what's happening here. It's very exciting.
Well, that's great. Robert Miles, owner of Downtown Concierge Services, thank you for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. You can catch the entire show online at WESA.fm or as a podcast in iTunes. This is Andy Conti. I'm an investigative reporter at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, sitting in for Paul Guggenheimer.